you know, the famous saying, grief is the price we pay for love. So when someone you love with all of your being is dying, there's often a desire to do again, to do like Wendy talked about, to fix it, to make it better, to not see that person die. And I think it's really important to keep thinking about and to help families and siblings think about what really is, where's the quality of life.
This is Best Aging Podcast with Wendy Wiedner and Josh Casper, brought to you by WJCW Media, LLC.
Hello, welcome back to Best Aging.
It is week three.
It is. We're working on episode three. Today we have a death doula, a person that facilitates a person going through the dying process. And her name is Deb Holtz, and her background's
advocate.
A little bit educator, advocate with disability services, advocate as the state ombudsman for long-term care.
An interesting opportunity to talk about death and dying. Welcome, Deb, and thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
Agreeing to be interviewed here and share your story about being a doula. Maybe you can start with telling us a little bit about your background and what brought you to being a doula.
Actually, yes. Well, and thank you both for having me. It's great to talk to both of you. I actually started in, I know I don't look this old, but I started in the 70s working with people with disabilities. The majority of my career time was spent really working with disabilities in terms of teaching and advocacy services. And I really didn't get into services supporting seniors until I came to DHS as the state ombudsman. And that's where I, well, met both of you for with all of your great advocacy skills. And I did that for about 8 years. And that experience, along with the fact that a very, very dear friend of mine had died several years before that. And that friend had some cognitive disabilities. And I watched him when he was diagnosed with an inoperable malignant tumor go through the process of trying to understand what was being told to him, process everything. And he just, everything went too fast for him. And I really had a desire to be with people as they were dying, to just kind of explain things and so that they weren't alone. And I think, and the ombudsman experience really shaped me in terms of seeing how many people, seniors and any age really, are alone through many of their difficulties and challenges that they experience, but especially at the end of life. And I'm not the first person to notice that. We have many, many great programs in the state and the country that talk about no one is left alone. No one dies alone. And that's a goal that really many of us want to have. And what drew me really to it also was the fact that I very much think death, and a lot of us doulas think this way, I think death is a process just like birth. Many of us feel death is birthing into the next world, the next spiritual world, that we're watching people lose their physical bodies, but their souls continue on. I have witnessed amazing things when people are at the end and when they actually start to transition and they see and they talk to their loved ones, many times relatives that have gone ahead of them. And I always tell families when that process starts, they're starting to transition. They are actually hearing, seeing the souls of their loved ones that went before them, who are saying, "We welcome you. We're here for you." So many of us feel that way. And I also, my faith guides me in that. I believe there's an afterlife. I think our souls go on. Now, doulas, and I especially, we don't we don't talk about our faith. That's not my role. My role is not to share what I believe or my faith or my strong opinions. If people ask, I will share that. But, you know, I've worked with people who are atheists or who aren't sure. And if they ask, I will share it. If not, my role is there, just there to be there to support them, et cetera. I think that was a long answer to a quick question.
No, that was really helpful. one of the things that that brought up with a question with me as you were talking about it and the experience that you have in your role of supporting people in the transition of death is, how does that affect you?
That's a great question. It takes enormous energy, and it's also extremely rewarding. I feel so blessed to share journeys with people. It's emotionally a lot. I never work with more than one or two people at a time. I prefer only one person at a time. But it's a very, very positive effect on my life. I have found that the more I focus on dying and death, the more I, and many doulas will say this, the more I focus on the joy of life every single day, because I have this big arch that I'm looking at, and I don't want to waste one day. I think I also, it can sound weird. I was talking to a friend this weekend, and she said, you know, well, what do you do for fun? I said, oh, I just, even before right after I said it, I knew it sounded weird. I said, I love being with people who are dying. And I, as soon as I said that, I knew that wasn't, I don't know, it was kind of a weird answer. But to answer your question, Josh, it actually energizes me. I am so honored and lucky if people feel comfortable enough with me to share those last moments. Both the person that is dying and the family and the loved ones, who often have a lot more grief going on than the person who's dying.
Yeah, absolutely. I imagine that this is at its utmost the most personal thing that they experience in life, and they're sharing that personalized moments with you.
Yep.
And that would be rewarding and energizing.
Yeah. And even leading up to that, a lot of people, especially men, I have found there's so many indignities that can happen to us as we age and as we are ending. Even before we're ending, just the aging process of, I've had some wonderful, always funny, I have to bring humor into it, but wonderful conversations about peeing your pants or pooping your pants or forgetting things. I kind of call it the brain, bowels, and bladder. They're all going to go at some point, and let's just talk about it. One of my clients a couple of years ago was a gentleman who was just so dignified, and he was at the point in his life where he needed to wear diapers, Depends. And so he had, you know, strangers changing him. He was, you know, urinating, and he couldn't control that. And so one day when we had gotten to the point where we really were comfortable with each other, he said something and it made me laugh. And I said, oh, please, don't make me laugh. I'm an old woman. I pee my pants. It's just a giggle. And that opened it up enough for him to say, hey, you know, look at me. And so we had a wonderful, humorous afternoon talking about peeing our pants. and sometimes that's the best way to do it with people. If you can talk about it, it's not as scary.
Yeah.
Lawyer to state ombudsman. I mean, if I was going to pick an hour-long conversation we'd be having with you today, I would never have put death in the top 10 categories. Of things to learn from you. And so, what was your journey to become the death doula?
I think Irving, this friend who died many, many years ago, that was my first wake up call that, I talk a little bit about it on my website. He was just one of my best friends, and he spent his life being a self-advocate for people who had cognitive disabilities, because he had very mild cognitive disabilities. But he was also born in the 30s, so of course anybody with a cognitive disability then got labeled, treated poorly, didn't get the support they needed. So he spent his life helping others understand. And then at the end of his life, he gets an inoperable malignant brain tumor. He was gone in 6 months, and I was so angry at God. I was still in the phase of my life where I would say I believed in God, but boy, when bad things happen, I was just devastated. And the last week he was alive, he was at Our Lady of Peace Hospice, and I can't speak highly enough about them. He was there, and he was in the state where you don't think the person is present anymore. And I was rattling on. Wendy knows, sometimes I just fill the space by talking, and it was just, there was nothing to do but talking. And his eyes were closed. He was just laying there. And I said, you know, I had a really, really rough weekend with the kids. They were horrible. They did this. The behaviors were just that. I'm ready to bring them here and just leave them in your room, Irving. And all of a sudden, his eyes popped open. And I just felt, it sounds so dorky, but I felt God in that presence. God was telling me, Irving can hear you. You're making a difference by being with him. We now know that hearing is the last sense to go. I was just flooded with this gratitude that God had reminded me people shouldn't be alone at the end. It would have been easy to leave him alone that entire week because you don't think he's there anymore. But he heard that. Mm-hmm. His eyes popped open, and it made me want to pursue more things like that. And then I didn't for a while because the ombudsman job came along, and that was just a dream job, an absolute dream job. You never know what journeys you're going to take, but that's how I really got interested in it.
Yeah, I agree. I would agree with that part. I remember as an ombudsman being with people that were in their last stages of life and telling family members that I know you think that they can't hear you, but please do not talk about things in front of them thinking that they can't hear you, because
I can
truly believe that they could hear you.
Yeah.
So was there any training involved in becoming a doula? And can you share with our listeners about how you qualify for that and what all that involved?
Absolutely, a great question. It's a little bit controversial area. There's no, Medicare doesn't pay for it, and Medicaid doesn't pay for it, and insurance doesn't pay for it. So it's all private pay. At this point in time, it's unregulated, which many people have challenges with and problems with. What has popped up really since about 2009, 2010, are programs that offer a certificate. So that means that some people misinterpret that and say, well, I'm certified. No, you have a certificate from a training program, an educational program that's going to teach you how to provide non-medical emotional support and often practical ideas at the end of life. And the training programs are completely different. There is such a wide variety. Some places offer a weekend training area. Some places offer more online support. Some places require that you shadow. I took a course from actually Deanna Cochran, who runs Quality of Life Care. And she was really after New York had really started some of this in about 2000, Deanna was the first one really that came up with a full certificate program and training, et cetera. And mine took about 18 months because it involved not only online meetings and teachings, but a lot of reading, a lot of research, a lot of practical things we had to, and it was very, very personalized, asking people to think about what they had witnessed and then what they were going to do. So that's the training and education that I took. But right now, there is no specific licensing for it. And that's quite a controversial concept because some people think it should absolutely go that route and then we could get Medicare to start paying for it. Others would rather have it a lot more fluid so that they have the flexibility to know what they're going to do. The other thing about doulas, end-of-life doulas, is that I've seen that there's an art that we all come with. It's the understanding of how to support people and really how to just be with people instead of doing something, which can be really hard for people like me. I'm a doer. I like to get things done. And I've had to completely change that personality deficit or strength, however you want to look at it, to just be with people at the end. But the controversy also is that there are many other cultures other than just the Caucasian culture that thinks that some of this is becoming maybe a little bit too professionalized. And I see that occurring. I see that with so many things. We start out with good intentions, but then it morphs into this medicalized, professionalized idea that, well, you have to have training to be with people. And I heard one doula talk once, and I thought it was excellent. If we continue to educate people how to be with others, maybe we would eventually eliminate the need for doulas because people would have that capacity. I'm not sure that we want to get fully to that point because I think doulas can really offer a bridge for families with hospice and other medical people, a bridge between different family members. But so the long answer again to your short question is it's a wide variety of training. If you type it in to the internet, you will find so many resources, including here in Minnesota. We have an amazing group in Minnesota.
Well, is there like a professional group that you belong to so you can support each other?
There is. We have both in Minnesota, the Minnesota Threshold, the Minnesota Deaf Collaborative. And one of the things I will leave the number with you after this podcast, but during COVID, several of the doulas in Minnesota, we struggled with how to offer support to people when we couldn't physically be with them. So in Minnesota, this is so unique, and I'm sure that we will eventually get it nationally, but we have a hotline in Minnesota that you can call 24/7 just to get advice, to talk to someone, to explore the idea of doulas. We created that. I wasn't part of it, but several people who are leaders in Minnesota created this as an option for people to call in and learn about different things that way. So I think we've done some really wonderful things here in Minnesota. I don't run a full I'm business with this like many people do, but many people go to the Deaf Collaborative and the Threshold on an ongoing basis and support each other. Yeah.
How is being a doula different than, say, being in a hospice program?
Excellent question. We are not here to replace hospice. We are here to support hospice, to add on to hospice. Hospice, especially in Minnesota, is just excellent. If people have problems with it, I always encourage them to contact a doula or an advocate. But hospice has become limited over the years in what they can provide because of the Medicare payments. And that's a natural thing that happens. But what we do is we can be the bridge between family and hospice. Since my core background is advocacy, I find myself drawn into situations and I get referrals from friends who know me about my advocacy background. And so I oftentimes will walk into situations where the family is getting maybe the physical things that they need from hospice, but they're not getting their other questions answered. And so I can be a conduit for the families with hospice. I can support the hospice if they have questions that they think they're not getting a complete answer from the family on. I can be very helpful if there's, say, four children of a mom dying and all four have different opinions about what they want and hospice isn't sure which way to go. So as doulas, we really support hospice. We want to be in addition to hospice. That's the best way of explaining it.
Yeah, that's excellent. And then again, we wanted to find out how COVID changed the path of a doula in the dying process.
Yeah. Many of us eventually did get into places, even during COVID. One of my last clients in person right before COVID was a woman who was living in her own apartment with her son. And so we had to navigate around that and it worked. But, one of the things that happened with COVID was I think we as doulas and family members, especially family members, really made the point that dying is not just physical. Because we knew during COVID, we said, yes, people are dying and for public health reasons, you can't come here. So their physical needs are being attended to. But we also know that so many people died in isolation. People died of emotional heartbreak. I think we were very successful in changing some policies in the state and nationally about allowing one or two people at the end. The other exciting thing that happened, because I'm just legislative political junkie, laws have been created in many, many states, and we're still working on it in Congress, that basically say in the case of any kind of emergency, so to looking ahead in case there's another pandemic or whatever happens, that people will have the right to have one or two individuals with them. We felt that was very important to get across to policymakers. One client that I have is in a group home and he has he doesn't speak. He doesn't have any cognitive abilities to let you know what he's feeling except through his eyes. And nurses and doctors aren't going to have enough time to do that. And so COVID was horrible for people like him. He needed people there. So with all the horrible things that happened during COVID, I think there were also blessings that we learned and we were able to share with others. And one of them was people can't die alone. Even in a pandemic, we have to work on infection controls. We have to work on safety for everyone. But we also have to recognize that emotional needs in both dying and living are just as important, if maybe not more important, than physical needs.
Wow, that's a powerful story.
It really is. And I'm kind of wondering about in terms of what I don't know that we've talked about really specifically is all of the variety of things the doula offers to the family and the individual who's dying.
That's a great, great statement and question. One of the core things about doulas is that many of us seem to focus on and bring expertise in our specific areas. So for example, there are many funeral directors who are becoming doulas. And what they focus on, in addition to just supporting people at the end, is helping the family and the client, if the client is able to, focus on maybe a green burial, maybe keeping the body in their home for a few days. Different ways to celebrate it. Other doulas have CNA training, certified nursing assistant training, and they seem to focus a little bit more on helping people understand the physical things at the end. Basic things that doulas should be offering are a presence, just being with the person, listening to them, helping them plan. When I initially started, as is typical me, I thought, well, I'll just do everything because I have all this good background. And so I was helping people with, you know, Medicaid applications, understanding Medicare, drafting wills, healthcare directives, and singing with people. And my national trainer was excellent. And she reminded all of us, and she still does today, focus on what is really your area. So my area, like all other doulas, is to sit with people, to be with them, to listen to them. But I also then add in my advocacy if they need it, and singing. Wendy knows when I left the Ombudsman program, I was a broken soul for so many reasons. The heartaches in the world had just gotten to me, and I let that affect my physical and emotional and spiritual being. But I remember saying at a meeting, well, you know, somebody asked, "What are you going to do?" I said, "I don't know. I just want to go on a beach and sing to people who are dying." And I'm living half that dream. I'm not on the beach, but I sing to people as they're dying. We sing maybe together before they are dying, or I will sing different songs to them in the process. And I find music so amazingly, I don't have an adequate word for music. You know, we know that music affects the whole brain, and it does things to us that almost nothing else can do. But so I get almost all my clients just through word of mouth. So people kind of know, maybe, you know, what they're looking for. But it's a great question, because there's such a wide range of experiences and expertise that doulas bring. But the core of it is to focus on the spiritual and the emotional, just because more and more people are recognizing that it's necessary, but our systems don't allow that. People who work in nursing homes know that. Doctors and nurses know that, but we don't allow enough time with the payment structure that we have, with the delivery system that we have. So I like to think of it as just giving people extra time in their lives to focus on some of the things that they're probably grappling with, and others don't necessarily have time to do it.
Right.
Time is a good word. I think we bring extra time to people.
Yeah. I think through our education and our training that we've become fixers. We want to fix things for people.
Yeah.
And you, in this role as a doula, you can't fix things for people.
Nope.
But the term just being present, just listening, and you don't even have to talk.
Yeah.
I found many times if you just sit next to somebody and listen. That's just exactly what they need. And you're there at the time when they need it the most.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure their families come in, like you said, the family of four kids, and they all want something different.
Oh, and they all want to fix. They're in grief. Their mom is dying, so they want to fix. And more than once, I've had to ask the family, okay, I hear what you're saying. So do you think you're extending her life or extending the death process? And that seems to help a lot of people. You know, there's this whole new movement that really started around 2011 with the death, it's called death positivity movement, or the death cafes. And I think people are slowly starting to think about, at what point do we stop fixing it and actually just be with people. Many doulas also call themselves anamkara, and that's a Greek phrase that literally means soul friend. And, you know, so that's what we try and emphasize too. And I've often said, I said to myself, because I need to keep learning things, I wish I had had doula training in the beginning of my career, because it has completely changed the way I try and relate to my teenage granddaughter and to my parents who are elderly, just to listen. I don't need to fix them. They may have things that they need to support them, but I just need to continue to be a much, much better listener. I'm working on that. I have a long ways to go because I have a long history of being a doer. And Wendy, you said it correctly. You know, we have to learn how to just be with somebody.
Right. And that's our training. That's,
yeah. You
know, yeah. Through advocacy, through social work, through being an attorney.
Yeah.
You want to fix things for people.
Law school
for all three of us.
Yeah, law school didn't teach me how to be quiet, you know.
I tried really hard and it never worked.
Still not working, Josh.
I'm wondering, one of the things I wanted to follow up that you talked about was the idea of music. And I'm wondering if you always had found music to have that kind of transformative healing part in your life, or is that something that developed later? Or
no, I'm a music junkie. I've been singing since age 2, and I played the piano, and I've always been just completely enthralled with music. And the more I worked in my career, I saw the amazing brain studies that showed how music affects the brain. I've seen miracles that happen with people with dementia, that singing the right song with them brings them back 30 years ago and they come alive. I used it when I taught children who were preschoolers with disabilities. We would sing about going to the bathroom, you know, aim for the spot, you know, and little things like that. Music just is a powerful, powerful tool. I just wish the whole country could sing a song together every morning and maybe we'd start healing a teeny bit. But I've always been a singer. I've always been into music and I've always been fascinated by the brain. I love looking at brain scans and PET scans and MRIs and all that stuff because the brain just lights up. And there's amazing research that shows how music is the one thing that goes to all these different parts of the brain. And it's just, it's a healer. So yeah, that's always been me. I love music. Hey,
you've given me an idea for another podcast.
Oh, yes. 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 Yes.
That's a great idea. So I have a question, maybe a little off topic, but have you worked with other cultures in the process of being a doula?
That's a really good question. No, I tend to work mostly in my area of life. I have one friend who is Hispanic, and his grandmother had come up here to live with him from Mexico, and he had called me to ask me about the fact that she was starting to see and talk to dead relatives, and so I explained to him what I thought was happening, and yes, it was time for hospice. But no, I have not. There are there's an excellent network of people of color, especially. There's really Alua Arthur. I'm totally in love with her. She is an African-American woman, and she talks very clearly about not only the death process, but leading up to that and all still the privileges that certain cultures have. I keep learning about it because my daughters and my granddaughter are from India and African American, and there's so many health disparities. It's a different system. I don't think I need to say this carefully. I think we have excellent resources in Minnesota. I don't think we are at the point where we need to be, because the doula network and the doula sharing is still very, very Caucasian, very middle class, white, middle-aged to older women who are doing this. Partly because we have the privilege to do it. Most of us are not doing this as a business. Most of us either charge very minimally, or if we have a practice, we really work hard to make sure that half of our services are not being charged. So, and I'm able to do that. I'm privileged because I'm at a point in my life where I'm not relying on this for full-time work. So it's a good question. And there's also, I have raised a lot of questions with trainers about the fact that I think in some ways, I know we need to be very careful, because many cultures have been doing this work for a long time. Shamans, they do it in their own community. There's the aunties and the grandmas in the town that everybody knows, and they've done this. So I think we need to be really careful that we don't take something that's already being done many places around the world and in different communities and different cultures, and professionalize it and make people think, oh, well, you know, we need to have a trained doula doing this. No. I think this is something that a lot of professionals have had to think about how we approach that. But I think we need to be really careful about the training that we're offering and the ways that we do it. But again, like I said, there's a good network of others. Not in Minnesota, though. You know,
in St. Paul, they have a large Hmong community.
Yeah,
I remember working at a nursing home with a gentleman that was passing, and their process in the family, and I had to do some research and learn some new things as to how their culture works in the process of dying, and educating the nursing home as to how they were going to have to change their thinking and to accommodate this gentleman when he finally did pass.
Yes. I recently was with my friend's husband as he was passing, and very, very nice place and a good place, and we could bring the dog every day, but could only have two visitors at a time. Well, there's many cultures, including what I want at the end. I want all my brothers there. I want them to see if I'm suffering. I want them to be, you know, making my life better. But many, many cultures and many families want to all be together at the end. And they also, they want to sing, they want to make noise. And this is a very, very quiet place. And I told my dad and my brothers last week, I said, nope, that's not for me. And my dad said, you don't want it to be calm at the end? I said, hell no. I want you guys laughing. I want a selfie. I do not want that ocean wave tranquil music playing in the background. I want the Stones.
I want Led Zeppelin, Stairway to Heaven.
Yep. There you go.
I'm wondering, you know, given the experiences you've had now, and what conversations, what questions, what discussions would you encourage people to have with their loved ones about, like, how to start the conversations about death and dying earlier, and to be able to have the conversations we don't have about death and dying?
Great question. People do not want to talk about it. I find, you know, when I tell people what I want to do, there's usually one of two reactions. Either they're interested, or more than likely, they think, oh, I want to go talk to somebody else at the party, because you're kind of a downer. I think it's up to us versus our older parents or older friends that we know to talk about things that we want. I think that often gives people an opening I think sometimes it's easier to start with the cut and dried practical stuff. Just saying things like, you know what? I did my healthcare directive last weekend. It's super easy. I'm sure you know this, mom and dad, but it's a great way to, you know, put down on paper how you really think, you know, that you'd end up at the end. Or to talk about positive experiences that people have. I think also the number one thing that I've seen people fear is not death necessarily, but the pain that could come with it. And so I think people need to open up those discussions by just saying, and I've done that a lot with my family. My family knows that I do not want pain at the end. In fact, I'd like to be a little high, so I'm kind of floating and just, you know, enjoying the process if it's enjoyable at all. But talking about different options that are out there, the world is changing so fast right now in terms of pain medication. Just looking at what's available to people, what's the best way to do it. Canada is interesting. They actually have progressed to the point where they're looking at psychedelics at the end, like mushrooms. And again, there's interesting data that shows how that can open up the brain at the end. And I'm not advocating for drugs on this show. I want to make that real clear. But just talking about what you prefer first can open up the door for a lot of people. You got to kind of wait for the moments too. It's definitely not a, not necessarily a happy hour discussion, although it might be easier, but, and each age is different. I find with the baby boomers, I think we're a fascinating group and sometimes an obnoxious group because we think we can control everything in our lives. And so now all of a sudden we think, we can control stuff either with maybe medically assisted suicide. I can get all the stuff I want. I'm going to die at home. That will be easy. That's kind of a push too. And so when people say things like that, I don't necessarily challenge it, but I just talk about experiences that I've had. For example, dying at home, I'll say, I think that's a great idea, Dad. Some of my challenges with that will be hospice doesn't provide 24/7. And unfortunately, that's what many people think it does. So I'll ask them things like, we could do that. If we do that, my brothers and I might be doing a lot of your cares. And I don't know, Dad, if I can wipe your bottom at the end, because I'm your little girl and I adore you. And so that gets him, to think maybe, what would some other things be? But just kind of opening the door with little, when you see teachable moments or shareable moments, I should say.
I'm wondering in terms of death and dying, is there any, and maybe for the professionals listening or for family members or other caregivers, things that as a doula you would advise people not to do with individuals as they're dying?
That's a great question. That's an excellent question. The number one thing I see is that people who are dying are ready much, much earlier than their family is. I would encourage families to first of all, recognize what grief is. Grief isn't just crying. Grief is anger. Grief is confusion. Grief is, the famous saying, grief is the price we pay for love. So when someone you love with all of your being is dying, there's often a desire to do again, to do like Wendy talked about, to fix it, to make it better, to not see that person die. And I think it's really important to keep thinking about and to help families and siblings think about what really is where's the quality of life? You know, one of my last clients, she was, Wendy knows this because I remember the famous ice cream case that you had, Wendy. You know, many times people can't eat certain things at the end because of swallowing difficulties. And I had a client several years ago, and her children loved her so dearly, but they had started to put some diet restrictions on her and, you know, what would be healthy. And I would never say it in front of the kids, but I would just tell her, you know, I'll sneak it in. You're 97. You can eat whatever you want. Just thinking about making sure that you're remembering this is about mom dying. It's not, it is about your grief, but that comes second. So the more you cry and the more you anguish in front of her, she's not going to want to go. We know that people need to hear not only it's okay to go, mom, but they also need to hear, I'll be okay because you raised me. I will be fine. Even if you think that you won't, it's important for people to leave in a peaceful way. I have heard that the four most important things we should be saying at the end of life are, thank you, I'm sorry, I forgive you, and I love you. Making sure that people leave with peace. I witnessed the death of a friend of mine in a hospital that was so unexpected and I had to make a split decision because I was his healthcare authority, and it was one of the worst deaths I ever witnessed because he didn't go in peace. He hadn't resolved issues. He hadn't heard me say, I love you at the end. He had heard his another friend sobbing uncontrollably in a corner and me getting directives from the medical person in charge. It was absolutely horrible. So one of the things I always try and remind people is make sure that they go gently, that they go with love, touch them, hold them, let them feel your skin. If they enjoyed that, my friend's husband who just died was not necessarily a touchy person. So when I went there, I just either sat with him or listened to him, or sang. But it's so much more difficult almost always for the loved ones than the person who is actually dying. So loved ones need to really take good care of themselves. They can't be there 24/7, and they need to take care of themselves so that they can be in an okay spot to say, I will be sad, but I will be fine. It is time to go. Go with peace. Go with love. Know how much I love you. And because they're transitioning, I always want families to remember it's not the end of the railroad. They're transitioning to the next journey.
Wow. That was, it really was.
That was powerful. It's, I think it's thank you.
I'll be okay. I love you.
I'll be okay. Yeah. I love you. Yeah, that's beautiful.
Sure. Yeah.
Thanks for sharing. Thanks for sharing everything
been
today.
Really informative.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I think our listeners are.
Now, you had talked when we started that you had a website that you wanted to share.
Oh, okay. So the hotline number, which is 1-888-351-8999. And in Minnesota, if you just go to Minnesota Threshold or Minnesota Death Collaborative, you will find so much information about not only the movement and the general ideas of it, but also you can find individual doulas. Almost every doula I know has their own individual website, which just kind of explains it. And most people, I know I do, offer an initial consultation. We just we want to be able to give people free support, resources, etc. So that's always a good way.
I'm going to go back to, you know, we talked about wanting to do, and we've talked about a lot of the aspects of doula that so much of it isn't doing, but being present.
Yeah.
I am wondering, from your decades of experience in policy, if you could change one policy that you believe would help people have better deaths, what would it be?
I can only pick one. I have a whole list.
Yeah, a way to kind of promote and support the doula system.
Gosh, you know, if it's high between pain management and being with people at the end, I think the number one policy we have to have, and again, many states are getting there, is the policy that when someone is dying, they need to be allowed to have another person there, whether that is family or a doula, et cetera. We can never repeat what happened during COVID, that many, many people died alone. I can squeeze one in. I'm also a huge proponent of pain management. That's a hard question, you guys. There's so many that would make a difference. Probably, you know, just the education and the information to people in training, nurses, doctors, advocates, et cetera, about what death really is, that that we stop treating it just physically, that we look at the whole person, that we remember to do that. You know, especially with people who can't express themselves anymore, people with dementia or people with disabilities, just remembering that, physical is just a teeny, teeny part of it. It's such a spiritual journey. It's such, I didn't answer that very well.
I liked it.
No, I think you did. Yeah, I like that part about education to doctors and nurses, because, again, they want to fix things.
Yes. And the pain management. We've got to get past the idea that this is how we relieve pain and we, don't accept the others. A client years ago was a very, very young person. She was the mother of a friend, but she was like, I want to say Susie was 62 or 63. And they just were not controlling her pain. And she didn't want to have morphine or methadone so that she would lose her functioning. And a week before she died, she asked her doctor what would be the best for her. And he said, marijuana, but it's too late to get you onto medical marijuana, et cetera. So, suffice it to say, without sharing any details, she ended her days in pain-free. I don't know. We have all these pre ideas of what we think is morally correct and wrong. And I think we just need to expand our options for people. And to give them the damn ice cream at the end, if that's what they want. No?
At the end of your life, yeah. I found that's kind of ironic that you're talking about somebody's health as their diet. It's just not healthy for you. Or in the case that I had a woman that was on hospice and she was actively dying, and they wouldn't give her ice cream because she didn't clean her plate.
Oh, God.
Clean her plate. She's like, she's an adult, and all she really cared for was ice cream at this point. And
I know.
We got her the ice cream, but she passed away 3 weeks later, and 10 pounds heavier because she ate a lot of ice cream. But she was very happy, and so was her family. But
I remember that case.
You would think, why do you have to fight with somebody over, you know, somebody's last wishes? You shouldn't have to fight with a nurse over somebody's last wishes.
We get into power structures, you know. I think, you know, so many of the challenges in the world are because of insecure people who have power struggles, and they need to hold on to that last grasp of power. And people have been trained a certain way, too. to honor orders to, so we need to just retrain people also.
This has been a interesting, informative, fascinating conversation.
As you walk away from it, I mean, if there's something I take away from it is just the idea of presence and being able to become, being able, I mean, if it's silence or whatever, but just being able to be present in that, in those moments, I think is a really powerful message to me.
Yeah.
And sharing literally the most personal part of somebody's life.
It's hard. It's hard stuff. But to be able to share that is just—it's a blessing and it's an honor. Yeah, I can't think of anything else that I'd rather be doing at this stage in my life. I'm very, very grateful that I was given this opportunity.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us today. And have a website if people want to contact you.
www.doulaDeb.org. And I love my website because I look really good in my photo. I mean, really good. And I've had a few clients with dementia who look at it, or their families will say, and I say, oh, you know, by this point I know them really well. I say, well, you know, Susie, you do have dementia, so you might not be, you know, seeing me in the correct way.
All right. Well, thank you so much for today, Deb.
I'm funny.
I want to thank both of you. I adore both of you. Wendy, you were just one of the best advocates I ever worked with, which is why you were, you know, sometimes a pain in my ass. But and Josh, you and Josh, you both can be a good pain in the ass, and that's the best thing I can say about advocates. I think you are both just amazing advocates, and you both make such a difference for so many people. And I'm thrilled that you are doing these series of podcasts. I love that you are continuing your advocacy this way by informing people and sharing resources with them. I love it. I just absolutely love it. So I'm so grateful to both of you.
I think our goal is to spark conversations in the community and
good.
Give resources and inform people.
Well, that was a great third episode.
I'm just blown away.
The idea of presence and the idea of fixer and how that came out and being able to be comfortable being present and not do anything else, realizing that you're not going to fix it, that the death is going to happen. And the four messages people need to hear as they're dying from Deb, I think was a really important message to hear. And just the idea of letting them know you'll be okay and that everything's okay and that they can go peacefully and that.
Yeah, I'll be okay. Thank you.
I love you. So I want to thank Deb for sharing that with us. And I want to thank you for coming back to our third week.
And thank you, the audience, for coming back. Thank you for listening.